Which flower makes you wet the bed?
What's daffy about daffodils?
And what's the difference between flower and flower?
Grab your gardening gloves, open your dictionary, put on your rose-colored glasses, because we're about to pick a fresh bouquet of etymological delights on this episode of Words Unraveled.
Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of the etymology books Once Upon a Word and Words from Hell. And we are in for a blooming good time on Words Unraveled today because we are exploring efflorescence in all of its forms.
Ooh, efflorescence. You're already going to have to explain that one. That sounds beautiful. Yeah, okay, so let's get straight into that because I can tell from that word there's a flower hiding in that word somewhere. And let's start with that word. Flower. Where does it come from?
One of my favorite things about this word is that the baking flower and the botany flower were originally the same thing, and they didn't diverge until like 200 years after they appeared.
You would totally automatically assume that these are just two words that they've converged in how they're pronounced, but actually they're very, very different. But they're not, are they?
No, they're like the same word, yeah. More or less.
And it's because they come from this French word or a Latin word ultimately that I suppose speaks to something being at its very best or its most pure, right? So something in flower is flourishing, although, you know, that's self-referencing a little bit there, or blossoming, again, self-referencing. Whereas I suppose flour, the powder, the meal, is wheat at its most pure with all of the lumpy bits taken out. Is that how you interpreted it?
Absolutely. Baking flour, sifted and refined, and distinguished from coarse meal was the flour of the grain. Similarly, we have the same kind of phrasing appearing in the medieval phrase, flour of milk, and that means cream. It's like the best part of the milk.
Yeah, that's right. The stuff that floats on top of stuff, it often gets called a flour in sort of old French and stuff. So it's not necessarily always that nice because like the scum on water can be flour, strangely, but I guess there must be something the fact that it's sort of, I don't know, alive, an essence of something floating on top.
It's also like why the crème de la crème is the like finest of the fine in society, something that was also referred to by the phrase, the finest flower of society.
And we get that word from French. So that is the sort of the romance word for flower. But if we wanted to go a bit further back to what we might have been calling a flower before we borrowed from the French, you have to look at words like bloom and blossom, which are the old English and the Germanic words for flower. And again, means something kind of similar because we do have that meaning of to blossom as a verb, of something to bloom as well, something to be at its ultimate best. And they come from this old English word blostem, which is B-L-O-S-T-M. And yeah, that's very similar to a lot of other Germanic words, particularly West Germanic words like the Dutch bloom and the German blumer. Yeah, they just mean flower.
All of these are also from the same Proto-Indo-European root as flower, ultimately. So is like blade and blood and bless, which literally means to like mark something in blood, which the implication here is like either living and thriving or kind of like the blooming spread of something creepy like blood.
Yeah, the thing that kind of links them or that makes the link easy, if you think that the Latin root of all of those flow words, flower, flourish, that F-L-O is related to the B-L-O of the Germanic words. And then you realize, oh, it's only, you just got to change that one consonant at the start. And you can see how these words can all be related from the F to the B. Actually, blow, by the way, is an old verb. I know we have that verb blow now, but spelt the same way that did mean to bloom. So you say this thing's going to blow. It means actually it's not going to blow up. It's going to flower.
You could probably argue that like an explosion is doing a bit of that same motion, right?
Well, I suppose just you could. Yeah.
Very quickly.
Just a very swift and dangerous bloom.
All the flow words you mentioned are from the Latin source florum. And we also get words like florid, meaning strikingly beautiful. I always feel like that word sounds worse than it is. I think it's because it sounds like livid and
horrid,
things like that. Yeah, horrid, morbid, things like that. So I don't know. But florid does mean extremely beautiful and flourish. And then the word I mentioned at the beginning, efflorescence, a bursting into flower.
Beautiful. And of course, Florida, we should say, the state of Florida as well. It's from the Spanish meaning flowery. It's either because when they got there, they thought there were lots of flowers there, or that they got there around, there's a feast called Pascua Florida, which means flowery Easter. And they landed around about that time. That's why Florida is called that.
Incidentally, Florida is home to much a great deal of flora, including famously orchids, which are a recurring trope on this show, apparently.
Yeah, we already discussed how orchid means testicle. And that's actually to do with the tubers, the sort of, I was going to say fatty, but they're not fatty, but the bulbous bits. Oh, Rob, the bulbous bits that are below the soil.
The top part can look like anything, including the other kind of knotty bits. But if you have like even any passing interest in orchids or in like horticulture and botany, highly recommend the book The Orchid Thief. It's a narrative nonfiction book that the movie adaptation is based on. And it is fascinating because it's like the cult around orchids and the different varieties. People get obsessed with like orchid hunting.
They are very beautiful and there are so many varieties of them. You can see why, they're almost a collectible.
Mm-hmm. I'll talk about a few in a little bit. But
yeah, we should get into some different types of flower. But there's a word that we should cover from Greek that means flower, right? I'll let you take the lead on this one.
So the Greek word for flower was anthos, not to be confused with anthropos, meaning human or man. But we have a ton of words, well, not a ton, a few words in English that are related to anthos. And not all of them are immediately identifiable as flower-related words, like, for example, anthology.
Yeah, I love that one. The idea that a collection of poems or text is a rich bouquet for you to enjoy, an arrangement of flowers. I love that.
Of course, an anthology by any other name would smell as sweet, but it is a gathering of flowers, which is lovely. There's also anthomania, an extravagant passion for flowers, say if you are an orchid thief.
An anthomanic.
Anthomaniac.
Mania, even better.
This is a maybe. This is a theory. It doesn't have any supporting evidence, but I like this theory. Apparently, antelope might literally mean flower eye in Greek, and it refers to their sort of strange-looking pupils.
Oh, that's sweet. Yeah, you wouldn't expect an animal. I mean, where does, I don't know what language antelope comes from, but
that's a good
it's not
question.
One of the usual suspects, that's for sure.
Another one is amaranth, which is from the Greek amaranthos, meaning unfading flower. Anth is the second part of that one. And it has a reputation for not withering. It's like the immortality plant of the floral world. Poets love it for its mythical and everlasting bloom. And it also does last a long time. And we also have the word amaranthine or amaranthine, which appears in Milton's work and means unfading as well. The thing I didn't know about amaranth today is that
I knew nothing about amaranth until today.
Well, okay, so floriculture in general has some of the wildest species names. I could make up a literal anthology of those that are both floral and poetic, but amaranth in particular has a name, prostrate pigweed, which is also known as the common tumbleweed. That's a type of amaranth, and many amaranths turn into tumbleweeds.
Oh, okay. So they sort of, well, they stop clinging on and
they dry up, right. They turn into a ball, and then they start rolling around and distribute their seeds elsewhere as they are dried. I used to get attacked by tumbleweeds all the time when I would go running in Colorado.
Really?
Yeah. It was the worst.
It's not a big problem over here, I'm saying. I've never seen a tumbleweed. No.
Just like bounce along or tangle up in your ankles while you're running. There are like 10 plant groups, by the way, that can turn into tumbleweeds, but amaranths are among them.
So, see, I was deliberately creating an awkward silence there so that tumbleweed could pass through. Right. Okay, let's do some more flower names, because there's some gorgeous stories to even some of the oldest flower names. Or did you want to do something else?
Well, I just wanted to ask you first, do you have a favorite flower?
Oh. You know,
I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
I do like, I'm not just saying this because this is where I wanted to go next, but I do like the daisy.
Oh, they're cute.
It's the simplicity, the cuteness of it as well. And since I learned the etymology of it as well, I've just had an extra adoration for this beautiful, common little weed, maybe, but cute little guy.
It's darling.
I mean, it means day's eye. It comes from the old English. So to the Anglo-Saxons, it was a dyer's eager. A day's eye. Because what does it do? It opens up in the daylight and then it closes back down again when the sun sets, which is, you know, really gorgeous. And Chaucer wrote about the daisy. I've got a quote here. He wrote something called The Legend of Good Women. And this is a text that I don't think a lot of people know about. I think they've heard of, obviously, the Canterbury Tales, and they've heard of Troilus and Cressida that he wrote. But in between those two, he wrote a series of poems that were dedicated to all manner of what he decided were virtuous women. So he wrote one about Thisbe from Pyramus and Thisbe, one about Cleopatra, one about Dido, for example, not the singer, I should say. And clarify that. It isn't his best work. It's not considered his best work. But he says in the prologue to it that he's been told by the god of love that he needs to write something nicer about women because he's been mean about them in his previous texts. And in that same prologue, he also talks about the daisy. He says, "And leaning on my elbow and my side, the long day I shope me for to abide, for nothing else and I shall not lie, but for to look upon the day's eye."
Ah,
daisy.
That's very nice. Mm-hmm. Does he also...
That well be reason... Oh, sorry, I'll just continue because he actually goes on to explain the etymology. He's doing his own words unraveled here. "That well by reason men it call May, the daisy or else the eye of the day, the empress and flower of flowers all."
That is lovely. Does he also, I was looking at the poem real quick to see, it doesn't look like he mentions the fact that there's another neat name connection here. The name Daisy is sometimes used as a nickname or a pet form of the name Margaret, because Marguerite, the French version of the name, is also a French name for the ox-eye daisy.
There you go. I didn't know that. That's lovely, isn't it? I can't think of another example where someone's nickname is based on like just a relative word.
There is another, but I'm blanking on it. Like, I recall there's another, like, woman's name that sounds completely different.
Yeah, I can link us to another flower, though, here, but we're going to go there via German, because one of the German names for a daisy is a Marienblümchen, which means Mary's little flower.
Aww.
And it's based upon a fable in which Mary, the Virgin Mary, is out collecting flowers for Jesus, the baby Jesus, and she cuts her finger. And hence, daisies have sometimes these little sort of red tips to their flowers, and it's called that. But we have our own Mary's flower, but to us, it is the marigold, which literally means Mary's gold.
I love that.
Yeah, and that is based around the Virgin Mary as well. Although the actual likely link between both of those flowers and Mary is the way in which they are sensitive to the desires of God, if I can put it that way. Basically, the fact that they open up, both of them open up during the day and close at night as if being driven by God's will, as if they have this sort of familial link with God, as Mary did.
It does really look like magical when they open up.
Yeah, you take it for granted as well. I mean, I think you can go most of your life not noticing that they do that, that daisies actually do that. Because, you know, you see them during the day and they're open, and at night it's a little harder to spot.
I have a number of green thumbs in my family, so observations of some flower behavior was the thing that I grew up with.
Can I point out what I think is another transatlantic difference?
Mm-hmm.
I think what in America is called a green thumb, we call a green finger in England.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we describe someone as green fingered, but I've never heard anyone in England call someone green thumbed, but I have heard Americans say green thumb. I'd be interested to know if anyone from Britain has used green thumb or if it's always green fingers.
I wonder why we're specifically using the thumb.
I mean, I can understand because you do plant seeds with your thumb maybe more often than you do with your finger, right? That's quite a common way of planting seeds. So yeah, green thumb makes sense to me, but I've only known it as green fingers. Maybe you get your fingers all sort of green from rummaging around. Who knows?
It's common for thumb to also kind of be a verb, like thumbing through pages or thumbing something. I don't know.
Finger could also be a verb.
Ha ha ha!
Let's move on to the...
You did that one.
I did do that. I've gone red. I'm watching my t-shirt. I don't know if the word blush is related to the word bloom, but I'm certainly
blooming. It probably
blooming.
Is. Yeah. I would expect so.
Yeah, it might be. We actually, yeah.
Well, now that you're the color of a rose, should we do that one?
Now, rose is great because the word rose is older than the word flower, which I think is amazing. And pretty universal across Europe. Like pretty much every language calls a rose something like a rose, and it means the same flower, which is kind of nice. It's from the, well, it's not ultimately from the Latin rosa, but we get it from rosa in Old English, and then we settle on the French version of it, rose, with the E at the end, you know, a bit later when after the Normans have popped over. But I think as far back as you can trace it, it just means that flower that we call a rose. Yeah, it's a rose.
And it's what we kind of like whimsically call a wanderwort too, right? It has relatives, distant relatives in like Persian and Turkish and things too.
And I think that wort that you've said at the end there is probably going to come up more than once during
probably
this episode.
So.
Yeah, which is in itself not related to the things that might grow on your fingers or elsewhere if you catch some sort of virus. Is it a virus? It's related to the word root etymologically.
Mm-hmm.
It shares the same root.
It was wirt in Old English. Also related, the primrose has kind of an interesting origin. Not a rose, but it is said to be, quote unquote, the first rose of spring. The prim there is, as in the Latin, primus.
It's the primary rose, although it's not a rose.
Right.
Yeah. There's clearly a use of rose that can be more generic than what we use it for now.
We've talked about how like plant and species names are anything but consistent, and they do a lot of trading and swapping and inspiring one another.
We've talked about the dandelion before. Oh, we're talking about quite common ones, but I think we should go over it again because it's a goodie, and there are all kinds of offshoots, if you will, of the dandelion. And we should start with where the word dandelion comes from, which is sort of straightforward. It's our mashing up of the French dandelion, which means lion's tooth, and you find it being called a lion's tooth in lots of other languages. It's a Löwenzahn in German, and it's a diente de león in Spanish. I noticed that in Dutch, it's called a paardenbloem, which means a horse flower. Interesting one. And in Danish, it's called a mælkebøtte, which means a jar of milk. Because if you noticed, if you like split the stem, this sort of white stuff oozes out. But I think most notable are some of the former names, or some of the many other names that we've had in English for the dandelion. Jess, take it away.
Well, just to follow up on a couple things you said real quick. In English, it is also recorded. It has a lot of names in English over the centuries. It's also called a milk witch at some points for the same reason as we have that other milky name. And sometimes it's called a witch's gowan, where gowan is a word for a marigold. So it's like an evil marigold. And that dandelion name is due to the fact that the leaves have that serrated edge. It looks like teeth.
Yeah, but we are talking about the sort of the yellow form of the dandelion. But then you've got the sort of the dandelion clock as well, which itself has had various different names. Normally from what it looks like once you've blown all of those fluffy bits off of it, like it's been called a priest's crown because it looks like a priest's hat, or a monk's head because it looks a bit like a tonsure, you know, the shaven bit on a monk's head, or it's been called a swine snout as well. But we're skirting around the
Yes, it's also been called a pissabed, a peabed, a wetabed. Let's see. Also sometimes just the French version of the name, which is pissenlit in French or pissenlit in English. Dandelions do have some beneficial components and have historically been used in various parts of the world as like a diuretic, for example. They are also sometimes used as like an herbal supplement. So it's possible it's because of their diuretic properties, but it's also might just be that like it looks like pee by the side of the road.
It doesn't really though, does it?
Well, sometimes they're called like dog pisses in other languages. In some Italian dialects, it's called a pisican, which is dog pisses, like for that reason, supposedly, because it looks like a dog has peed on the side of the road.
Now, what I think is quite interesting is that we have cast aside the pissabed name in favor of the dandelion, the dandelion. But in French, it's now pissenlit is the actual name for it. And they've sort of left dandelion behind. And they've stuck with that. But I don't think the average French person gets the sort of the the fact that that says piss at the start of it. I know the French for peeing is also very similar, but at the same time, it doesn't quite make grammatical enough sense for it to mean that. A bit like dandelions, not obviously, you know, a reference to lion's teeth.
They've also been called tell times due to the practice of like determining the time by picking mature white dandelions to see how easily the, I don't know what they're called, the little things come off and float away.
I think I called them fluffy bits.
Fluffy bits, that's
scientifically
good. They have a name.
Not very effective clocks, I have to say. I don't know how that name has endured, really, because I've tried to tell the time with one of those, almost always wrong.
Yeah, apparently the idea is like the number of puffs required to blow off all the seeds would be the number of the hour, but I don't think that's how that works.
We used to do that at school all of the time.
Oh.
Yeah. I don't know why you would do it more than once. You go, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. Is it 3 o'clock? No, it's 1 o'clock. Well, why am I going to do this again? Anyway, it's endured. It's endured. It's good fun as well. Oh, another one that has a kind of similar sort of folk story to it is the forget-me-not, by the way, which I feel like we could reference it at this point. There are a few explanations for why it's called the forget-me-not. I think the original is the German vergiss mein nicht. And the story that's told around that name, although, by the way, forget-me-not doesn't always refer to the same flower across different languages. It just refers to whatever flower they've decided potentially has this property of meaning that if you're wearing it, your lover will not forget you. But the German folk tale that's supposedly behind the German name for it is that there was a knight out picking flowers for his paramour, and he drowned. Whoopsie. In a river. And the last thing he said was, vergiss mein nicht.
Oh.
Don't forget me.
Oh, that's delightful and horrible all at once.
It is, isn't it? A lot of German folk tales do involve
right.
The person dies at the end.
Yeah, you know, that, honestly, that well. that one's pretty tame by, yeah, by yeah, German exactly. folklore standards.
Yeah, at least he didn't get his fingers cut off.
Oh, goodness. Another one with like potential folk tale properties is the foxglove. It's a little mysterious. It's literally meant like foxglove for all time. And it has these little bell-shaped blooms, kind of like glove fingers. Its Latin genus name is also digitalis, for the like digits of your fingers. But why it's a foxglove is a little mysterious. It could be that they grow frequently on hillsides where foxes make their dens. Some folklore suggests that foxes wore the flowers as little stealthy paw covers to be quiet. And then the aptly named scientist Henry Fox Talbot proposed that it was originally folk's glove, where folk means fairy. So it's a little fairy glove.
He's deliberately trying to somehow extricate himself from his own name from that of the foxglove.
Right. I mean, all evidence points to it always being a foxglove, except when it is a witch's glove. And that's because they are extremely toxic.
What the foxglove theory has in its favor, though, is that there are other names in the British Isles from the languages, the Celtic languages, that call it things like, so the Welsh name for the flower, or one of them, is an elves glove, it translates to. So this idea of it being like a little person's gloves, it exists, you know, in the locality of where people are calling it the fox glove. So maybe
so it certainly could have like folk etymology evolved over time.
It's the ultimate folk etymology to work mm-hmm. the word folk into
yeah, exactly.
etymology.
Literally.
Yeah, it is. But that said, they're like the size of a human, a fully grown human finger, aren't they? I mean, it looks more like a...
Yeah, they're large and lovely. You could, like, I don't know, they make you want to poke your finger in it.
Yeah, they do. They do. We've also called them finger flowers. We've called them lady gloves. Mm. We've called them a dead men's bell.
Okay. I mean, it's because they're toxic, right? Don't eat.
Yeah. Yeah, please don't. And yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the bell-shaped. A fairy thimble. That's quite a cute one.
Oh, that's
or
a
fairy's petticoat. Yeah. All names for...
That's even cuter.
For the foxglove. Yeah, but we've settled on this one that we can't really explain.
Another fun one that has to do with clothing is the tulip, which is quite a globetrotter. It's ultimately from Turkish and Persian words for a turban, and it looks like a turban.
That one absolutely blew my mind because obviously well, I don't know if it's obvious, but I always think of the Netherlands when I think of tulips from Amsterdam, but if they're obviously not, they're from Central Asia. And and the name is similarly sort of oriental, which I think is really cool. I had no idea about that one, but it just means turban. Wow.
Another fun one is the daffodil. And this one gets real goofy because it's like the word is daffodil. What we now call daffodils go by the botanical name Narcissus, which we discussed on our mythology episode in Ovid's Metamorphoses. Narcissus was a beautiful youth who fell in love with his own reflection in the water and not realizing it was his or sometimes just loving himself in general. He like died over it.
And supposedly where he died, some sort of flower grew.
The word is essentially a mangling or a misunderstanding of the Dutch phrase meaning asphodel. The Dutch daffodil, or daffodil, just means the daffodil because daffodil bulbs were supplied to Britain for a time by the Dutch, but it's ultimately a riff on the word asphodel. But asphodel today is a word for a different kind of plant, one that's yeah. not quite as glamorous. They're also associated with Greek myth. The asphodel meadows is the underworld realm where most ordinary souls end up after death. It's not as nice as Elysium. It's not as horrible as Tartarus. Your spirit just goes there to like hang out. And it's not known exactly what it means, but some people who have studied the Odyssey, in which this realm is mentioned, suggest that it might mean fragrant or flowery, and asphodels might bloom there because they're sort of this muted off-white, gray, and ghostly color.
I see.
But the goofier part of daffodils is the many different spellings we've had in English, like affodils, daffies, daffodillies, daffodowndillies, and daffodoondillies.
My grandma calls them daffs.
Aw.
Well, she did.
That's cute.
Yeah. She died.
Aw. R.I.P. Grandma.
How about the mimosa? Ooh. I had a mimosa the other day with my brunch. What I insist on calling a Buck's Fizz, but what the menu I was reading called a mimosa, you know, a mix of sparkling wine and orange juice. Mimosa's called mimosa because the name is related to the word mimic, and it's because it supposedly mimics the sensitivity of an animal in the way that it sort of recoils or turns in on itself. Its leaves turn in on themselves at just the gentlest touch.
Aw.
Yeah.
That's very nice. Also kind of creepy.
Don't ruin it. What's it got to hide?
We're not used to seeing the plants like move actively.
Oh no, it is. Yeah, that is creepy. When you walk, yeah, if you brush past it,
yeah, right.
Like that. Yeah, that is kind of creepy.
You can do that with cucumber plants too. Like if you touch the little tendrils, they will like wrap around your finger.
Oh no. Yeah. No.
I have a cucumber plant named Benedict cucumber plant, and I'll let it hold my hand.
Of course you've got a plant with a name.
All of my plants have names. I also have a scary tree, like a little bonsai whose name is Sideshow Bonsai after Sideshow Bob on The Simpsons.
You've got to give us some more of these.
I do have a plant that's named Dracula, and then another one that's just named Vlad, and those are vampire dahlias. They're a very deep red. I love dahlias. That might be my favorite flower, maybe aside from a tiger lily. By the way, dahlias, I believe, are named after the person who discovered them. There are a lot of flowers named after people. This one's actually funny, but gardenias, you would think, are named after the fact that they're in the garden, but nope, they're named for the extremely aptly named Scottish-born American naturalist, Dr. Alexander Garden.
No. Nominative determinism.
Right?
At its finest.
We also have the magnolia named after Pierre Magnol, forsythia named after William Forsyth, freesias named after Friedrich Fries, wisteria, Caspar Wistar, the zinnia is Johann Gottfried Zinn, and then the begonia after Michel Begon.
They're hidden in there, aren't they? They're subtle. I don't have a lot more flowers, Jess.
Are you familiar with the origin of the word iris?
Iris is a goddess.
Yes, a goddess of rainbows.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Okay. Specifically, the goddess of the rainbow and the dazzling messenger of the gods, but especially of Hera. Her path is traced by rainbows, and the iris of the eye was so named because it adds that pop of color. And then iris flowers themselves are also lovely and colorful, but iris means rainbow.
Oh, that's beautiful. So it's so efficient in its beauty as well, just those four letters.
Absolutely.
What about a petunia? I noticed this one. Worth a mention. So the petun bit in petunia is from a Guarani word for the tobacco plant. So South American word for the tobacco plant, because the petunia is related to the tobacco plant.
Interesting. I didn't know that at all.
No, it's a new one. And there is a verb, which is to petune, which is something that you do to tobacco to bring out its flavors and its aromas.
Another one with a touch of sort of mysticism and mythology is the anemone, which was a flower before it was a sea creature, a genus of flowering plants in the buttercup family. It literally means daughter of the wind, which is very beautiful. It's thought to open only when the wind blows, or perhaps that the delicate petals could easily be carried away by the wind. Neither of those is particularly true, but maybe that's the lore behind it. The story from Ovid is that when Aphrodite sprinkled nectar on the blood of her dead lover, Adonis, they bloomed from his blood.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mythology behind these names. But I mean, the thing is, the mythology gets in the way, doesn't it? Because often the mythology is thought up to explain the name rather than the name created based upon the mythology. So it can be a diversion away from finding out where these words actually come from sometimes.
Absolutely. And then just because someone will ask, I'm sure sea anemones are named after land anemones. And from what I understand, it's because they're colorful, but I have to wonder if it has to do with the way the sea anemones like move in the water, because they're also called wind flowers, the land-based ones. So I wonder if maybe it looks like they're blowing in the wind.
Because it undoubtedly does, doesn't it?
Should we talk about one of the more controversial words across the pond?
Yeah, because I think we should talk about herbs.
I think we should talk about herbs.
Why would you want to talk about herbs?
Because that's how it was spelled in Old English, and it makes sense for it to, well, okay. It makes sense for it to be spelled E-R-B, like it was originally E-R-B-E in Middle English.
We're just going to pretend that H isn't...
Yeah.
That H isn't...
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah, consistency. Internal consistency.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. When you go to the opital or the stay at an hotel. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So we're evoking a French word, aren't we, when we say herb these days?
We adapted it from Old French, and in French it had no H. If it did have an H in French, it would also not be pronounced.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. There's this weird thing. We also have it with words like, we say homage in English instead of homage, right? Sorry, in British English. Whereas I think homage might be more likely said your side of the Atlantic. Yeah. And it's almost a sort of double snobbery that brings about homage and maybe even herb as well. It's because homage and herb do sound more sophisticated because they so clearly evoke the French. But if you are even above needing to do that, then you can just say homage.
There was a period of like pro-French sentiment and anti-French sentiment, depending on which side of the pond you were on. And that's how we got this. It's basically just pettiness between like, we're being not American, we're being extra French. And there we go. It's always petty. Also, I just said that the French word for herb doesn't have an H in it. It totally does. It was just the old French that didn't have the H.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Yeah, we got that. We got that, don't we?
Okay, all right.
But I wanted to talk about some herb names because I ran out of flowers that I knew. But I stopped off at one that I thought was probably related to a flower, rosemary, and was surprised to find that it is not related.
It has nothing
in any
to do
way
with roses?
Etymologically to roses. No, there's no link between rosemary and roses. It is a folk etymology. It is where we've taken a word that actually we've got from French and we try to make it seem more English by turning that R-O-S. So the original word is rosmarine in English, or romarin, as it is in modern French, and the ancestor of which we would have taken rosmarine, which was sometimes what we called it in English. And we turned it into rosemary because, well, you've got two very English-feeling elements there with the rose and the Mary. But it actually comes from the Latin rosmarinus, which means dew of the sea.
That's incredible.
You tend to find it, in nice coastal parts of, the Mediterranean and what have you. Yeah, it often is growing.
I love rosemary.
Me too, actually.
It's a delight. And lavender, which is also related to rosemary and has a flower on it. So look, we got another one.
Lavender's a weird etymology, one of those sort of controversial etymologies as to whether or not it is indeed related to the idea of, for example, a lavatory, or what's a laundrette, for example? You know, is it to do with washing?
The theory is that it has to do with that you would wash something and make it smell like lavender because it was an early like scent.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. It was a big theme of my wedding was lavender. We had lavender all over the place because My wife's from the south of France, where it's everywhere. The place smells gorgeous for it.
I bet it does. I would rosemary. Love to visit that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. Parsley is another one where we've just sort of butchered the original name that we got from the French, but it ultimately goes back to petrosilinum is the Latin name for it, but that comes from the Greek words of petros or petra and selenon.
So is that rock something?
Correct. It is. It's rock celery.
Huh.
Yeah. But that petra is the same rock we get in, you know, petrichor or what other petra words have we got? Petrified.
There we go.
there are others.
You know, the words just left our brains.
So yeah, parsley. It's in Germany, for example, it's petersilia, which is you know, a much closer borrowing of the Latin. But we've just taken all of the syllables out, and we've just been left with parsley. Coriander is an interesting one. So let's talk about transatlantic differences with coriander. And what would you call it?
I have thoughts on this because, like, coriander, if you have like the seed, that's coriander for me. But if you have like the green plant, it's cilantro, which is the Spanish word.
Mm. Yeah. So you draw a difference there. I mean, the leaves are coriander. It's all coriander over here. But coriander and cilantro have exactly the same Latin root. They both come from coliandrum, which is the Latin. And you can just see how you run that through either a French filter and you get coriandre, or you run it through a Spanish filter and you get cilantro or something closer to it. Yeah, and the actual meaning of coliandrum is another sort of debated one. There's quite a satisfying explanation, albeit a little bit gross, that it comes from the Greek colis, which means a bed bug.
Oh.
Yeah, which in other languages is called, for example, in French, it's called a punaise, which means a stinker. And coriander is so-called because it smells kind of bad, basically. Hence, like a bed bug. But really, there it's quite possible that it's just actually a word that has come from somewhere else into Greek, and they've had to apply their own orthography to it, and they've ended up with something that just so happens to have the same constellation of letters as their word for a bed bug.
You know, kidding!
And
wow,
really explained it away like that. Basil. Which I would pronounce basil.
And I would pronounce it basil. But that one's really cool. That one has royalty in its blood, right?
It does. Yeah, it's related to basilica and basilisk. So a basilica is a royal palace. And yeah, you're absolutely right. It's from the Greek for royalty. And the last one that I wanted to mention is Ras el Hanout. Have you ever had that spice? It's a mix of spices, and it works absolute wonders if you want to make, I don't know, a Moroccan dish or something like that.
Maybe I have then.
I'm going to upset someone who's really hot on their tagine, and they'll say you absolutely shouldn't use Ras el Hanout in there, but I don't know. But it's from the Arabic for top of the shop, Ras el Hanout, and it's supposedly because there's the spice monger. What do you call somebody who sells spices?
That sounds good to me.
Merchant spice, the spicer? Spice monger, spicer would give you their best. They would give you a mix of their best spices.
Oh, that's very nice.
And hence it's called. I actually did hear one explanation of it that it was called top of the shop because it was prepared above the shop. But I much prefer that idea that it is the best that the shop has got to offer.
Yeah, I like it. Top shelf herbs right there.
Yeah, some top shelf herbs. Ras el Hanout. Anyway, thank you for letting me go off on a herbal tangent.
No. I have a couple. We haven't addressed the fact that time has nothing to do with time, and sage has nothing to do with being sage. Time's origin is unknown. It might come from the Greek thymon, meaning courage, or it might be from a root meaning it might be thymio, which I believe means like to fumigate or to smoke. Neither of them has a lot of great evidence behind it. And why it's affiliated with courage is also unknown. I do wonder if it's perhaps a symbolic thing, because sometimes flowers have connections, as we've discovered, to mythology. But this one is a little unsatisfying, but it has nothing to do with time. So we've got that part, at least. And then sage is from the Latin salvia, meaning to heal, for its preserving and healing properties.
So it's like a salve.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, exactly. It is from the very same root. Same with dill. Dill is from an Old Norse word meaning to soothe.
Oh, that's nice. An Old Norse one. Okay, because really we've been hanging around mostly the Mediterranean when we've been coming up with these herb names. But dill,
That one is a standout for sure. But dill has existed in Old English and has cognates across a variety of Germanic languages.
So we can thank the Vikings for that one.
As is tradition, we need to introduce a little bit of goofiness into this discussion.
We're going to keep it clean though, right?
We'll find out. But
okay. Yeah, let's talk about some of the more quirky flower names.
My favorites tend to be the, and what I've brought to this discussion, are the varieties of flowers that people have cultivated and named, often in very whimsical ways. Like orchids, since, as we've discussed, there are many, many variations. They have silly names, like the monkey-faced Dracula orchid.
That's not real.
Also sometimes called the monkey-faced orchid. So Dracula is a genus of orchid, either because of the association between several red species or because they have little fang-looking petals, which is probably the latter is probably the case. And the monkey-faced orchid, you should look it up because it looks like a tiny little monkey face.
No way.
It does. It's like super, like obviously a very cute little monkey face. They only exist in like the cloud forests of Peru and a couple other places. My favorite one that I've seen is the hanging man orchid or the naked man orchid. It has...
Naked man's orchid. Come on.
It has these little petals that look like bodies coming out, like all attached by the head in the middle, and in between the legs on the body there's a little something, so it's definitely a boy.
This orchid has orchids,
right? Exactly. On a less alarming note, there's also like a certain kind of tulip orchid that looks like a little swaddled baby when it's blooming, and then there is an orchid that looks like a flying duck, so it's called the flying duck orchid. And there's a tiger face in moon orchid and Virgin Mary in moon orchid. And if you look inside, you see a little tiger face, or you'll see something that looks like a tiny carving of like a Catholic Madonna inside. Goofier still, we have the pussy toes, which is moving away from orchids. These are not orchids, just to be clear. The pussy toes are these little spring flowers that look like tiny cat's feet. There's also sneezeweed, which is based on the historic use of crushing the dried leaves to make a snuff that would intentionally cause sneezing. Like if your nose was stuffed up, you would crush up sneezeweed and make yourself sneeze.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, at least it follows through on its name.
Oh, yeah. No, it definitely does that. As a person with allergies, a lot of plants could be called sneezeweed.
It was sneezeweed.
There's also cheeseweed, which is named for these frowned flat seed pods that look like little wheels of cheese. And then there is the butter and eggs, which is also called the yellow toad flax. It's a yellow and white wild flower that looks like butter and eggs.
Delightful. Delicious. You know, a while back, Merriam-Webster, the publishers of the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, they did an article called Flower Names That Sound Like Insults. Ooh. And it's well worth your time just to go through them. But let me pick out a few of my favorite ones of those. You've got the cowpea, which is actually, the pea is P-E-A at the end of it. And it's a genuine legume that's sometimes cultivated to feed cows.
I found my painstaking. We talked on a previous episode of the podcast about the fact that you didn't realize it was painstaking. You thought it was painstaking.
Yeah, all this time.
Mine is cowslip. I thought it was cowslip. It is not. It means cow slobber, cow slop, or cow sh-. Like it is, it is an Old English word because it grows in cow pastures.
So, yeah, okay. I mean, it's... you've ruined it for me, but I did know that it was slip rather than was cow's lip. Yeah. You also got this screw bean, by the way.
Screw bean. That definitely sounds like an insult.
Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? It's a bean that looks a bit like a screw. It's got what looks like a thread around it. Bladderwort is another good one. A hoary vervain. How about that one? Ah! It's a hairy perennial herb.
That's horrible. I love it.
Yeah, there we go.
I feel like hellebore also sounds like an insult.
Yeah, he's a hellebore.
Right?
Yeah, well, next time I'm going to call him the hoary vervain.
Well, on that non-helleboring note, let's close up like a daisy at dusk and wrap up this podcast episode.
Indeed. It's been blooming wonderful to reuse a joke that you used at the start of the episode. We'll catch you next time on another Words Unraveled.